Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skipping Fancy Show.
The protagonist says Chew Toy with Betsy Dornbush.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And we should obviously say that we are talking to Betsy Dornbush. Welcome to the show, Betsy.
Thank you.
So for those who are not familiar with you and your work, would you like to say a little bit about yourself?
Yep. I write primarily epic fantasy right now. I've written a lot of short stories, and I edit the magazine Electric Spec. I've been doing that for about 10 years.
Ooh, that's a long time.
Yeah, we're pretty proud of it, actually. We're pretty happy to have made it this long.
So I do want to ask a very, very important question, which is specific to your website, which describes itself as sex scenes at Starbucks.
I asked her this exact same thing.
I have to know, what is the deal with that?
You know, honestly, it's been so long, I don't even remember. And I know people are going to think I'm, like, lying about it, but I don't even remember. I know I was in a Starbucks when I thought of it, but I wasn't writing a sex scene. And I don't know. My friend said, hey, start a blog. You should do this new cool thing a million years ago. So I did.
Do you think writers actually write sex scenes in a Starbucks?
I think they absolutely do. Yeah.
Gosh, I feel like that'd be really uncomfortable.
And there is a sex scene on my blog somewhere. That could be like a little scavenger hunt for someone if they could find it. Again, a million years ago.
That's great. That's great. So we're here to talk. Well, in particular, we're talking about Emissary, but that's not the first novel in this particular series. The previous one was Exile. Mm-hmm. So we should talk a little bit about the series more broadly before we kind of get to the specifics of Emissary. For those that maybe are not familiar with Exile, so kind of give us a sense of where this story has begun and where we are now in Emissary, without obviously telling the whole darn story of Exile, because I have to read that too, or else.
Right. Exile, it's pretty obvious from the title. The guy is an exile. His name is Draken. And he is falsely accused of murdering his wife and exiled to an enemy country. They have sort of a weird fatalist view that the gods say that they shouldn't execute people. So they sort of give him a chance to go live somewhere else if they've done something awful. So he basically, at the beginning of the book, is basically shoved off a ship and has to swim ashore of this enemy country. Oh, and then you want to know about an emissary, he has to go back. So I tried to figure out the worst thing I could make happen to him, and he has to go back home. After many adventures in his first country, or in his, well, his new country, then he has to go back to his old country and have awful adventures there.
I mean, indeed, that's true, because the opening of your book, you don't pull any punches. The very opening of the book is a sort of mini invasion within his new homeland.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of becomes the spark that leads him back home. So I wanted to start there because it's an interesting tactic to kind of open a book with basically mayhem and destruction and as a massive degree of confusion. And I was curious, what was the impetus for kind of beginning a book with what is essentially just violence?
Well, I really like writing fight scenes. and I wrote the book, I started the book 2 years ago, and I had it pretty well laid out in synopsis. So I always had it start with kind of an emergency like that. And I didn't, I just, I guess in a second book, especially, I figure, you know, yeah, you're going to get the occasional person who's going to pick it up who hasn't read the first book, but most people have or understand that it's a second book. So I felt a little more comfortable sort of starting in the middle of action. And I think it, you know, it raises the stakes for him. And it also puts him in a really awkward situation because very few people know that he is from the old country, which is now invading his new one. And so he knows a lot about them, but he has to pretend like he doesn't, or sort of pretend like, oh, well, I've studied them, you know, which made a lot of awkward situations for him.
Yeah, and that's certainly true. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, that's a really interesting tension you have through most of this book, where he tries to keep his heritage secret, even as he's going there, which I thought was really interesting. I mean, it almost feels like, in a way, that he could have made things easier if he had just fessed up. So,
yeah, so, he's mixed race, so he's pretty sure that, and there's a lot of prejudice in the new country, and so he's pretty sure that something really awful will happen to him if people find out his secret. So he pretends to be completely Brynian, 100%. And he's also inherited a position. And so there, you know, it's the typical, you don't want a lot of question around that.
Sure. Go ahead, Sean.
Actually, that leads me to something I did want to talk about, because, I mean, this world you've sort of constructed is in many cases a very prejudicial world. It's a world where we do have slavery, for example, and that becomes a tension that's in the book as well. It's in the opening, I think the second chapter or third chapter, that's actually one of the things that's brought up is, you know, in the middle of what is now essentially a kind of mini war, there's this tension over actually ending slavery as somebody who himself used to be one. And we have the other kinds of prejudice that exist in terms of racial prejudices. We know that people just basically hate anyone who's of mixed race to an almost extreme, violent extent. And I'm curious, I mean, this kind of stuff sometimes crops up in fantasy, maybe not as concentrated as it is here. And I'm curious if you were using any real-world analogs as a kind of the basis for that.
You know, I used to teach. I lived in Wichita, Kansas for a while, and I was a teacher, and I was in schools, and the schools there, because of history art, they bus kids all over, so the schools are very mixed. There's a lot of prejudice in the city, and so they don't really do, I think, a good job of integrating neighborhoods and stuff. They're still very separate, you know, separate entities. And so I found myself in this odd position when I moved to this new town with my husband, that I was working with a lot of kids of different races, and I loved all of them because they were just all awesome, and I love kids like crazy. And, but I encountered, from other friends and family, some prejudice around that. And so I found myself kind of having to sort through that, you know, where it became very much my life that was just how I operated in a very mixed race environment. And so, and by mixed race, I mean, you know, multi-race environment. And so I guess to me, that's kind of natural. And so I wrote the book 10 years ago, so I wasn't really thinking to make a statement of any sort. But that was just sort of, I guess, to me, a natural world. And really, they are different races, but a lot of their prejudice sort of revolves around the magic systems, that because each race sort of has their own magic, and they're all kind of a little bit selfish with it, and so they don't really trust each other. And there's some religious stuff in there too that affects how people think.
Yeah, I want to get into that religious stuff later. So, in addition to the real world examples, I was wondering if you had taken any examples from, say, genre literature about emancipation and slavery, since Draken's efforts at emancipation are a theme that go through the book. I was thinking of, say, like Joel Rosenberg's Guardians of the Flame series back in the 80s, for example, or Octavia Butler or other authors. I was curious if you had dipped into any genre works that deal with slavery in their imaginary worlds as inspiration for constructing your own?
You know, I can't claim any certain story. I'm not nearly as well read in my own genre as I should be. I read a lot of fantasy as a kid, and I kind of gave it up, you know, because of where, you know, when I grew up, it was sort of like a, you know, that was a kid's genre, sort of. That was something you sort of moved on. And then I went into reading like tons of mysteries. And really, it's only been since I started writing fantasy that I started really getting back into reading a lot of it. So I don't really have those like 80s and early 90s examples to fall back on. So, you know, I really think, I'm sure I did read some things that affected it, but I really think a lot of it was just my life that I had led myself.
Sure. Your turn, Sean.
My turn. Well, actually, Paul, I think that would be a good time to actually jump to the religious question because it's somewhat related to this. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's go there. So you do have you do have several varieties of, the way you use religion in the books. There's a whole atheism versus piety strand that goes through the book. And you also use religion as a tool of rebellion and revolution. I was curious as to what your motivations for doing that and your inspirations and what you were trying to accomplish.
Well, I think that was, you know, I think that was pretty much inspired by probably by two things. One, the real world. As we see it now. But also Draken himself is so, he is a believer, but he does not like the gods.
He is
a bitter believer. And so the idea that, I mean, I guess, you know, I really write to the character, you know, and I always think stories should only be able to happen to that character. And I always think really in the whole story, only to Draken could it happen that there's a religious revolution that's more religious than the people around him already. And he's like, oh my gosh, you guys are even more wrong. Except, you know, he almost has to fall on the side of the gods, in the story to be able to fight it. And so I tried really hard to put him in that sort of awkward position where he was going to have to rely on the gods. And he gets, I don't think it's, you find out so early, I don't think it's really a spoiler to say he gets gifted magic, by the gods. And so it's sort of a, you know, it's really difficult for him because he gets these gifts. But, you know, he kind of doesn't really want them. He doesn't want the responsibility that goes with it, you know.
Sword, which is also from the gods and from the first book. So, yeah, it's like he accumulates these things, and it's like an entanglement with the gods that he really doesn't go with. It kind of reminds me of, like, say, the fiction of Tim Akers in some ways, where he mixes in a lot of religion and magic and God meddling with ordinary mortals, whether they will it or not, and sometimes they want nothing to do with it, and they're still stuck with having to deal with them anyway.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's seven gods, there's seven moons. It's pretty obvious that the gods exist. He gets a lot of proof that they exist, so there's never any question that they don't. So for him, it becomes much more of an issue of sort of how to get out of their spotlight, and he just can't.
Well, he's in a high position, so it's not like, I mean, it's not like he's living as a peasant farmer or as a slave anymore. So he doesn't. Of course, the gods are going to watch him. He's got a country to practically run. So
right, exactly. Well, part of one, yeah.
Part of one, yeah.
Yeah, part of one. I do like there's a line I either thinks it or he says it out loud. I can't remember. Where he basically says, like, I'll do whatever I wish, until the gods desire otherwise.
Yeah.
So disinterested. Like, everyone else is like, oh, the gods. And he's like, yeah, don't care. Like, when they show up and they want something done, I'll listen then. But until then, I'm doing whatever I want. Just stop.
Right. Well, and he has a way of upending everything that gods want him to do anyway. You know, he gets a gift and he doesn't use it the way that they want him to anyway.
Yeah, such as using his sword like a flashlight.
Right. Well, you know, the sword is so funny because when I first set to write X, I wrote it as a trunk novel. I mean, I really did purposefully write it as a trunk novel. And so I allowed myself to write any trope I wanted to, but I had to switch it around somehow. Like that was my rule for myself that, okay, I can use whatever cool trope I want, but I have to flip it somehow. So the sword was just natural. There had to be a magic sword.
Well, and that's actually something I did want to talk about because, you know, you are writing what you would describe as epic fantasy, and I think that's probably a fair assessment. And it's one that involves a lot of very familiar tropes for fantasy. I mean, we've got kingdoms in disarray, and we've got magic swords and gods, and it's maybe a little less familiar, the kind of religious angle. But there are kind of a sort of collaboration of these various tropes at work. And I was curious how you felt kind of in terms of weaving them together so that they didn't feel sort of trite.
Well, I think that there were times that they do. But, you know, I like the tropes. I've been on a lot of panels and a lot of panels about tropes. And if you ask the audience, okay, what are some tropes you hate? What are some tropes you love? You know, as soon as someone calls out one they love, 12 people say, oh, I hate that one, you know? So I just picked things that I thought were cool. It's hard to admit because I do plot now, but Exile was my last book that I didn't plot. So it's hard for me to talk about it like, oh, how did I weave it all together? Well, I feel like I got lucky because a lot of things did sort of just fall into place. But I don't know, you know, like once you have necromancy in a story, that's going to really affect a lot of the other magic that happens around it. And, you know, there's only so many things like a sword can do, which is pretty much hurt or kill. And so there's only so many things you can do to upend that. I'm not sure if I'm really answering your question or if I'm just sidestepping it.
No, you're answering. I think it's fine. Yeah. I think that's a fair assessment that, tropes are not necessarily the issue. It could be perception, how readers respond to tropes, or in some cases, just how you actually use them.
Right.
You know,
right.
You can have talking dragons that are cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like a lot of that from fantasy. I mean, you know, and I think that there's this huge trend and push now to push fantasy, which I think is great because I think science fiction and fantasy is the perfect genre to always push the limits. But I don't want to see, some of the cool things that we love fall away either. That we've always loved about, you know, fantasy.
So the
tropes are not always, tropes are not always bad.
Right.
Sure. It's how you use them.
And in some cases, you know, fantasy can be about the kind of the classic stuff at the same time as it can be sort of pushing the envelope.
Uh-huh.
Do everything. And that seems to go along with certain conversations happening in the genre world right now where there is, not to go into specifics, but this idea that, you know, the gosh wow fun stories aren't getting the recognition they deserve.
When right.
Actually, they are. They're just getting a particular segment of the audience. They're people who love Star Wars adventure novels.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
Other kind of things like that. So
yep.
Fantasy can be all kinds of things, I guess, is kind of what
we're right. Talking. Exactly. Yeah, I think there's room in the genre for a lot.
I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I do too.
Paul, you want to jump in?
Yes, I do, actually. So speaking of things that haven't always been done well in fantasy, you do fairly, very well in the two novels is your female characters. I was thinking specifically of Elena and of Draken's half-sister. I'm going to pronounce it wrong. Erinne. Just looks too many letters to be so
that's
simple.
That's a question I get all the time. Yeah, so, I know, but it looks cool on the page.
It does! It's like, how do I pronounce this?
That's why that name is that name, because it just looks cool on the page.
So, I was I wanted you to talk about the genesis of your female characters, and especially of Erin A's relationship with Draken, which is one of the best things in this entire book.
Oh, thank you. You know, that was so fun to write. They have such a great charisma together, and I don't even know how or why. They're both so damaged in so many ways that I think they understand each other on a level that no one else in the story understands them. Mm-hmm. I love writing. It just is, their scenes are just almost write themselves because, one, you know, she really doesn't take any of his shit. I mean, she kind of is like, well, you're really grim and cause he's grim and he has a problem with depression and, you know, he's kind of a little bit of an Eeyore sometimes. And so she doesn't really let him be that way. You know, she kind of expects him to step up. And she kind of expects him to be a big brother, which he's never been in that position before. And I have two big brothers. It's kind of a unique role to be a big brother. So, you know, she pushes him in directions that he hasn't gone before, which is pretty cool.
And he has to learn to adapt to a sister who's not going to take his shit and do what she wants, especially. I mean, it's like he didn't want her to come along on the trip, for example, and she comes anyway, right. Just because
she comes anyway, right? Yeah, she does do what she wants, but a lot of it does revolve around him. She's pretty reliant on him, probably way more than she would admit, because of her past, and you know she was basically. Given over to someone and taught to be an assassin. And so, which you find out in Exile pretty early. And so, she has to kind of come to grips with being in a family too, but she doesn't, I don't think she does it as well as Draken does. She needs her freedom. She needs air. It's like, she's always running off, you know. She kind of just appears and then runs off and does what she wants. She thinks she's helping a lot, and sometimes she does.
She kind of reminds me of Zartan in some way, just like peering his office out of nowhere. It's like, what the heck?
I know. I love, you know, she loves that too. She loves surprising him. You know, that's, to her, that's like, it's fun to be sneaky and surprise someone. Because I think she really thinks he's sort of this, I mean, she kind of idolizes him. You know, and that's totally me being a little sister and probably idolizing my big brothers. So, you know, she likes to catch him off guard because I guess, I don't know, maybe it makes her feel like he's more real and approachable or something. She just saves his butt more times. I mean, she really does. At least she's a good fighter. That helps.
That does help. So one of the, this will hook into the other major theme we have. One of the other interesting themes you explore in this whole novel is the idea of fatherhood for Draken. And
right.
So I was curious how you develop that, especially in his very sometimes tempestuous relationship with, the Queen Elena.
Yeah. Yeah. They have a really difficult relationship. And you know, he's a little, you know, he has his own prejudices and his own little bit of sexism there going on sometimes, but she outranks him and clearly does and isn't afraid to pull rank. And, so he has to deal with that. And yet, you know, he really loves her and wants to care for her and help her. So it's just, I'm a parent. It's sort of one of those things that it's such a shift in the relationship once you add people to your little couple, you know? So I wanted that to happen to them. I wanted them to be, to go through some of the frustration. And she's, you know, she's pregnant. She doesn't feel good. Bad things are happening and she does what, I think I wrote this in some interview somewhere, but I mean, she does what every pregnant woman that I've ever known does, which is you get up in the morning and you put on your pregger clothes and you go to work, You know, she has to do that anyway. And he really would like for her to just stay all nice and safe and maybe bed rest and eat bonbons until she safely has the baby. And she's not having any of that. She knows she's the queen. She has to go to work. So she does.
It also does provide a nice amount of tension to the book, like in that opening scene where he's desperately afraid that she's hurt, the baby's hurt, and it kind of drives him forward. And we shouldn't spoil the latter half of the book and what happens, right. But yeah, it's a continual little crank that you can keep him worried and focused on what it means to be a father to be.
Right.
And it's a nice contrast too, because he lost his previous wife, and and readers of the first book know the story of that, and we learn a little more in this about how that all came down and what was going on with that. But yeah,
right.
I found it interesting. And Alena's not his wife, just to clarify for readers, because they can't marry, they basically have a long-term relationship, but it's not marriage. But I found, like, comparing the old relationship with the new relationship, and can he do better this time? And I almost think he's like haunted by what happened to his wife, and he doesn't want that to rear up again. So maybe he's too protective of Elena.
He's absolutely too protective of every woman around him. He's surrounded by these really powerful women, and he just doesn't get it that he does not need to rush to their rescue, that they, oftentimes they got it, or even in the flip side, they're coming to help him and rescue him, because he does get himself into spots that are pretty hopeless.
Yeah, as I said, human chew toy.
Yeah, yeah. My son is like, really, Mom? Really? You're so mean. I'm hoping it makes him a little scared of me. You know, he's 16, so.
Did you want to jump in, Sean?
You know what? I had a thing I wanted to ask, but I lost it because I had to cough.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it doubled my brain cells, and I now lost it. But I will just make a joke instead.
Okay.
Which is that what obviously happens in this book is that Elena is eaten by a dragon, and he has to go and alive, like you know, like with the whale and the Bible and all that stuff. Like, she's still alive in there.
Right.
So, and he has to go rescue her.
Yeah, that's actually kind of a good analogy.
Oh, good. Yeah. I made an unintentional analogy.
Unintentional analogy.
This is great. I am
impressive.
A super smart person. Paul, but do because I did lose my question.
I can keep talking, sure. Okay, so let's jump to world building, because world building is one of the things I love so much in fantasy fiction, and of course, that's something I read for in any fantasy novel, including yours. Mm-hmm. So I was curious about the layout of the seven cities and how you decided to come out with this, with these cities. I mean, they're all surrounding Sister Bay, but they're all butting up against each other. I was curious as to how you came up designing his home turf, so to speak.
Yeah, I kind of was imagining, you know, little villages on this giant bay that just sort of grew over hundreds and hundreds of years and crammed up against each other. And so, you know, and people do just tend to segregate and segment themselves. And so, you know, one city is more kind of the bankers, and one city's more the royal city, and another one sort of they're called landed, but they're the lords and ladies of the realm. And then there's, you know, it is on a bay. So then you have sort of this, you know, the dock city, and then there's one that's got, more of a sort of a military bent, because it's where the military boats go in and out of. So I was just thinking, you know, it's almost like, you know, the sprawl in California or whatever, how you can almost look at cities and tell, where, in trying to imagine what it looked like, you know, 100 years ago, and there weren't as many buildings, and then they just keep putting them in and filling in, and that's sort of how it came to be. And of course, they're not, you know, it's all under one king, so they're not warring with each other or anything. But I kind of imagined like old you know, walls and stuff, like the, you know, the Roman wall in Istanbul, stuff like that, that you would see in some of these ancient cities. So that's kind of how I envisioned it. And there had to be seven, because there's seven gods and
seven gods,
or seven moons, and they, you know, seven is like the number that they have to use. Yeah, seven's like the number they have to use.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah, I was thinking like medieval world cities all cramming up against each other. You still have the walls. I mean, they're under one ruler, but it still feels like, yeah, almost like they're like shoulder to shoulder with each other. And I can almost see where tensions could break if that ever broke apart completely.
Right. And I don't know if it's easy or hard to tell on the map, but spreading down, it's sort of like, you know, we have a place near a lake, and so, you know, the really nice houses get the best views, and then they sort of go, you know, then they get really little as you get further away from the views. And so I don't have the map in front of me, and I haven't looked at the city long enough to remember what the cities are called.
I've got the map in front of me, of course.
But the sort of king city has the highest ground. So it's most protected and easiest to get to from the rest of the country. But it also has, you know, the best views of the bay, because it's sort of at the peak of the bay and looks out over the water. And then it's sort of almost... It literally and figuratively goes downhill from there.
You got Ashwick and Cordwyn and Shadow.
Yeah.
Osper, Coldbank.
Coldbank. And some of them are from gods, and some of them aren't.
Wyndham and Newport.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I had the map up on my board, but I don't have it right now.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a map guy, as everybody on this podcast knows. So, yeah. Uh-huh. So it's like, ooh, map!
I love the maps that I got. They did a great job.
So I did want to jump in on this while my throat is holding up and I don't start coughing again, even though I sound really pitiful. It's actually kind of funny. But on the world building thing, one of the things that you do actually explore are the differences in the kind of military tactics that are used by both groups. And it should be noted that this is fairly early on, it's revealed that from a power standpoint, Draken's people, his adopted people, as it were, are in a position where they probably can't win a protracted, official, like, militaristic war with his home country.
Right.
And so there is an effort on his part to sort of prevent the possibility of war, because it would be so devastating. But one of the things that we learn early on is there is this drastic difference in terms of the tactics that he's aware of, that but his adopted people aren't aware of. I mean, for example, we see the phalanx actually getting used here for reasons I don't quite understand, because the phalanx is obviously the most perfect military formation in the history of time. They still lose.
It's not the most perfect.
I'm kidding. I'm kidding, but it is very effective.
Roman maniples, boy.
I don't actually know what that is. But in any case, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about kind of developing the military tactics, kind of the ways in which people kind of design their militaries based on their kind of culture.
Well, I think Monea, that's the country, his old country, that has just such a big army. They have so many people. If you're developing, I talk to a lot of people who are a whole lot smarter and better read than I am about this, and so any mistakes are definitely mine. But I wanted them to have a weapon and tactics that would be taught fairly quickly, so you can get, you know, basically your people out into the field almost immediately, which I think would be a fair assessment of a really large army that's trying to keep it manned. And we went around today actually with the audiobook. Nick Sullivan's going to do the audiobook, and he and I had a big talk today about how you say Sax. I've been saying it Sax. I'm probably wrong. He's going to say it a different way in the book. We'll see. But that's a weapon that is just sort of, it doesn't take a ton of skill to use. And so I wanted them armed that way. And I wanted them, so I had to think, about what kind of weapons he would, you know, Draken's people, who he doesn't have very many, especially at the beginning of the book, you know, what they would have on hand. And pretty much swords or bows, they have some, they do have some war engines, but they're actually all locked up in the building that's being held siege. So they can't really get to those. And it doesn't really help them because you've got, you know, they're coming in, behind a siege, behind a quick siege. And so, he has to figure out a quick way to beat that. Because, you know, you take a long sword against a short sword and you're in really close fighting, it's going to be really tough to swing a sword with much effect, if you're really in tight quarters. And so he had to almost build his own war engine, which is what he kind of does with his horses and his men. And they, you know, they all, I don't know. I think of the Brynians and especially the Crasians as being very, culture proud. So, you know, they're certainly never going to use some plain weapon. They're, you know, they're kind of cocky about what great fighters they are. They're overly cocky about how great they are. And so, they wouldn't use a plain weapon. So most of them are, you know, proficient in sword, and bow.
Yeah, I definitely got a this is showing my interest. I got almost a quasi Roman or Greek sort of feel from the Monaeans and
inspired it.
Versus Germans, Celts, Angles sort of thing because the Seax is definitely a Northern European weapon and not to mention Draken knows about Monaean military tactics, but he has to fight against them, but they're much, and less disciplined is not the right word. It's a very different kind of war they're used to. They're not used to fighting armies like that.
Right.
Especially armies that outnumber them. So.
Right.
So.
And he knows that all along. He knows that this is going to be really tough and that, you know, and like you said before, he keeps trying to tell them this is not a battle you want to fight this way. You do not want to engage them long term because they are too good and they have too many men who can die. Well, they have men and women that fight on both sides, but they have too many people to die basically. And so if you have a ton of people to die, you don't need really great skills. So I like that dichotomy of that. I like that the sort of cocky small person going up against the you know, the person who's probably just going to win without maybe even trying all that hard, you know?
Yeah, there's definitely a military dichotomy. I mean, that which explains why he's so insistent. Like, they want me to be the ambassador. I'm going to be the ambassador. And it's not spoiling too much for the readers, but yeah, that's the reason why. That's why, even given his position, he winds up going on this trip back to his homeland because he realizes pissing them off is just going to lead to more conflict. They know they can't stand. I mean, they already had a conflict in the first book.
There's a long ago conflict, which they soundly lost, in which Crasia tried to invade Monea. He just can't believe sometimes their arrogance because he's like, you guys, you know, do you remember? Do you remember that, you know, all the people who didn't come home? and it's sort of a generation, you know, it's not quite a generation ago. I mean, he's a little older. He's an older protagonist. So he's, you know, he's like between 40 and 45. So, you know, he was a fairly young guy when this was going, you know, when that first thing was going on. And he just doesn't, I don't know, it's funny. He just is like, really? You guys don't get this, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that I appreciate about the novel, because though it does open with fighting and death and mayhem, it is a novel in many respects. It's about efforts towards diplomacy.
Definitely.
And so it's about trying desperately not to start a war that would be costly and devastating, unlike some other fantasy worlds where everybody seems determined to murder everybody as much as possible, or where diplomacy mm-hmm. is about screwing other people over. His intent is essentially to stop it, to make it so it doesn't happen, which I find interesting because Draken and the Queen Elena, they're diametrically opposed in many respects, because one of the first things she says at the beginning when he asks her, you know, what are we going to do with the people who've surrendered from this initial attack? And her mm-hmm. response is, kill them all. Mm-hmm. And of course, he thinks that's a terrible idea, but he's not going to argue with her because she technically has the authority. He has to kind of follow the order because that's kind of the power dynamic at work.
Yeah.
And I love that his decision is actually to find a nice medium. Well, I don't know if it's nice so much as it's kind of a weird middle ground. And that's kind of, he's kind of trying to navigate this tension, right? That he has in-depth knowledge that suggests that the tactic that his adopted people are most likely to use is the one that's most likely going to kill them all, or mm-hmm. ruin them at least. And he's desperate to kind of find a way to kind of mitigate that throughout,
right.
through diplomatic.
Well, and he doesn't understand why they're attacking. That's the one thing that to him doesn't make sense. You know, they've basically been in peacetime. At some point kind of runs over, well, it seems like trade's been okay, and it seems like, you know, we've been getting along pretty well, so why now all of a sudden? And so when she says kill them all, he's thinking, but I know I need to interrogate them. I need to find out why they're here, because otherwise more will come and we won't know why, and we won't be able to fight it, you know. He just walks a balance between his two countries all the time through the whole book.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's definitely true. And I think it makes it very interesting, because it's not just a book where it's just about war, it's about all of the complicated political and sometimes conspiratorial mess that is mm-hmm. that, you know, makes what is essentially feudal nation building very difficult.
Right.
And I love that tension between him and Elena, because their relationship is like a little microcosm of his relationship with his adopted country.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yep.
So anything in between them is sort of exactly what's happening with his countrymen. And I think that's just a really fun tool.
Yeah. It's fun, but their scenes are really hard to write. They have so much subtext. They don't talk to each other. They don't really trust each other as much as they should. And so it's really, they're probably the scenes that take me the longest to write whenever they get on the same page.
I did love though that in the opening scenes, you know, she's like 7 months pregnant, I think is how
yeah.
she's pregnant. Right. So she's like, she's really preggers, and she's like, you know, at this point, probably like super cranky,
uh-huh.
easily, like, you know, you mess with me, I'm probably going to bite you,
mm-hmm.
You know, as she's free to be, because she's carrying a human child.
Right.
And I love that her response to the attack is, I'm not going to sit here and like be taken captive. I'm 7 months pregnant, but I don't give a shit. I'm picking up a sword.
She's not wimpy at all. There are times, I mean, you know, it's funny because she does show a softer side sometimes. And he almost, I think, forces it on her. I don't think she ever would, except when he kind of makes her. It's interesting. You go around and around with, you know, I do anyway, with writing, especially female characters, and making them real and making them, you know, you don't want them I think I wrote for you guys the blog post about agency. You want them to have a lot of agency, yeah. but you want them to be real, and everyone is vulnerable sometimes. And so for her especially, it's really tough for her to be vulnerable. So those moments are are pretty fleeting, but he just kind of clings to them almost, because to him it's like he really wants to take care of her, you know.
Yeah, and you bring up a very excellent point, because I wrote something a while back on my blog about the controversy about agency in Jupiter Ascending, because there's a big argument about, oh, well, she doesn't have any agency, and therefore she's not a good character because she's got almost no agency, and yada, yada, yada. And I kind of rejected that, because I think the problem with talking about agency in that kind of way is that it assumes agency is, like, you either have a lot of it, and therefore it's valid, or if you have almost none of it, and therefore anything you do is invalid. When really it's more of a spectrum that people have agency within the specific subject positions they may be in. So right. In her case, right, she's bound in many respects by her position. Mm-hmm. You know, she has to behave in many respects in certain ways, but at the same time, right, she has all of this personal responsibility that goes beyond just the nation, right? She's carrying a child. She has Draken, who she has a kind of troubled relationship with. She's got all of this, so she's kind of navigating all of these things, mm-hmm. and in that way sort of demonstrating a very complicated sort of agency. And the novel deals with this in other ways too. You have characters who are slaves, you have characters who you know, in Draken's case, he has this history, this past that he doesn't want anybody to see, and yet he really does want to protect the people who probably at some point, if they found out, would probably reject him,
right?
You know, this very complicated picture. So I think that's kind of a good illustration of that idea, that agency is not a zero-sum game, I guess, is what I'm kind of getting at.
Right, right. And, you know, and it's tough to write, especially in a violent world, it's tough to write agency without fighting. But people can fight. Sometimes surrendering is fighting, and people can fight in different ways, and also it doesn't mean that everything has to be immediate. Like, they don't have to react immediately. I'm thinking of, because you brought up earlier this, that they're slaves, and that someone actually brings that up to him and sort of pressures him to free the slaves, which of course would be hugely disruptive culturally. And I mean, he wants to be clear, he does want to, but it would be, he's getting a better sense of how disruptive that would be culturally and financially to the whole country. And now he's like got this, now he's got these people attacking, and he's like, yeah, so, you know, I really want to do this, but it's kind of slid down on the list a little bit. But it's really difficult for him, because he was a slave, and he knows intimately what that means. And so if it was up to him, he would certainly be doing everything he could. But I like playing with that. I always think of that in terms, you know, people always complain about, I guess, the president or, you know, Congress or whatever, about the things they're doing and the things they're not doing. And, you know, you just think of all the things those people do in a day, and having to constantly decide and prioritize what comes right now. You know, what's going to happen? What do I need to work on right this minute? And so I tried really hard to make that real for him. And of course, you know, since he was a slave, it's that was a natural thing to throw at him.
Sure. I mean, he's gotten, since the first book, a fair amount of power, but he has all these rules, restrictions, and the culture and society to deal with. He can't just wave a magic wand and emancipate the nation.
Right.
He might want to, but I mean, there's consequences to him not going through the emancipation, but mm-hmm. we'll leave that for the readers to discover.
Yeah.
But it you do bring up that tension as, like, he knows he wants to do the right thing, but it's not as simple. There's no easy answers in your books, which is one thing that I appreciate.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I try. To me, there aren't any easy answers anywhere. It might be just because I have teenagers, but but it seems like there are no easy answers. You know, many things are not set in stone and are different for different people. You know, people have different perspectives on it, and I try to respect that in my fiction, that not everyone is going to see things the same way. And sometimes Draken's a little bit of an unreliable narrator. Because he definitely has his own biases, his own prejudices, his own view. Like when he goes back home and meets the royal family, which he knows them. You know, he has to deal with his old prejudices and dealing with that in the person he's become.
His arrival at the palace is one of and the conflict that erupts there. That's another nice set piece you have in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was thinking too when you both were talking that there are these cultural conflicts that he wants to correct but can't because he's kind of bound by the complexity of the social situation, right? That the mm-hmm. easy answer would be right. to just end it, but you can't because it would be devastating. Which, you know, morally may be questionable, but ethically is less so because if you just make a massive social change, right, there are consequences for that. And while it may be the right thing to do, it may also be the wrong thing to do in that method. So he finds ways in some respects to kind of buck those, the traditions that currently exist. I mean, there's one moment in the book where he finds out one of his slaves has had a relationship with another slave and that's been ended because the owner has sold the slave.
Mm-hmm.
And his response is, well, no, as prince of this place, I would strongly suggest that person reconsider buying that slave.
Yeah, that was great.
Yeah, he'll do, you know, little things. If he can't do a big thing, he'll at least do a little thing. Just to prove to himself that he, you know, that he can and still is a good person. I mean, he does just so much killing in this book that, you know, I think he comes out on the other side thinking, I am like, you know, my hands are bloodstained permanently. You know, I am so broken. Like there is, you know, he constantly feels like there's no real goodness in him. So, when he can do something a little bit good, even he takes that opportunity, which of course means that he actually isn't the horrible person he thinks he is, but you know, depression lies. So, that's sort of what he goes through.
Yeah. That is a really good line. I mean, I went through the book. I mean, after what happens at the palace, he tries to throw away his sword because he's just so sick of it all. And he can't even get rid of it. And it comes back to him. It's like, what the hell?
Yeah. he doesn't, it's another trope, right? That you're sort of, you have your hero caught in a fate that they're not going to be able to escape. But a lot of heroes, I think, in fantasy don't try to escape their fate. And he definitely does.
Yeah. It provides that grit throughout the books.
Yeah. He spends a lot of time covered in blood, by the way.
He does. He doesn't, you know, and then you end up with all these logistics like, okay, so he's covered in blood and what does that really mean? And then, you know, he's got to take his shirt off because gross. And then he's got to find, and it's cold outside. So he's got to find new clothes. And there's this constant issue. I felt like I was constantly having him, you know, run around looking for something to wear. There was times just because you wouldn't wear, you know, I mean, it's fun to think of that you might, you know, I guess in a video game or something, but in real life, you're not going to, I would think even someone who's used to killing would get the really nasty shirt off as fast as they could.
Yeah, and it does present an issue because, you know, the war is really, like, especially war of this kind, it's bloody and gory. I mean, you go through it in a lot of very visceral ways. I mean, you like talk about like the stench of entrails at one point. You don't. It's not coded in that way. You like make it the language sound nicer than what I just uttered. but like you're very specific that there's blood and there's gore and it's, you know, this disgusting experience. Characters get ill just from the sense. And it does raise that question, which is, you know, after you've had a massive battle where you've like lobbed off heads and limbs and stabbed people through the heart and you're covered in blood, well, like, what do people do at that point? Because it's not like they had, you know, like well, post-war, we'll roll out the big old giant showers, and we'll all just shower and get it over with, right?
Yeah, there's no... Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes he ends up, like, in the water conveniently. but, yeah, there. I try really hard to make... probably one of the things I try hardest with is to make the battles real, so that you feel, you know, like they're icky and they're gross and they're not, it's not fun. And it's, and you might get over the fear of killing, but at some point, all of that's going to catch up with you. And sometimes it's going to catch up with you just in the fact that you're a mess, you know? And you're sweaty and you're gross and you've got maybe a sword that you have nothing to clean it on because there isn't anything clean, you know? And so I try to throw that stuff at them, at my characters, so that it feels a little more real, because I don't buy stories that don't address it in some way.
Right. Kind of, another way to kind of say that is, it seems like what you're doing is trying to de-romanticize medieval war.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, people running heroically. I mean, even in some of the fights he has, like, he almost gets killed.
Right.
You know, he's not the glorious prince who just flies in with the glowing sword and is like, slay thee, and like, pja.
No, he's not. He's not. Well, and one of the ways I bucked the trope of the magic sword is that he actually is not, and I won't give away the secret that helps him learn to be a sword fighter, but he is not. He was raised to the bow. He is not a sword fighter, and so he has a lot to learn. And so for him, that up close fighting is really strange, and it's not something, you know, it's not something he dwells on or anything. But it's definitely something he is going to notice as a character, where, you know, other characters might not, but he definitely would.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So, Paul, before we jump to some other questions that aren't maybe specific to the book, do you have any last questions about the book?
I was curious about some of the minor characters. It's actually going to bridge into what you're writing next, if we're going to see any of them. Like, say, I'm going to get the name wrong, yeah, like Captain Eurymantha.
Oh, Eurymantha.
Yeah, I liked her a lot, but we only see her at the beginning of this book, and she has a tie to him all the way from the beginning of the first book. I was curious if we're going to see some characters.
Well, she does appear in the middle of the book.
And then kind of drops away again.
She does. She kind of drops away again. And
I liked her. Because she was there at the beginning, as it were, of the whole series, because she ran the boat that dropped them off.
Yeah, it'd be a nice book, you know, it'd be a nice little bookend if she appeared, like, in the last book, surprise him. I think I left her, like, he assumes that she's going to be dead. So she was backing away last time. Yeah, she's pretty open. She could be, you know, it's like the old soap opera rule. If you didn't see the funeral and the body in the casket, then they are not necessarily dead, and you can bring them back at any time. So we didn't see her dead body. So she could come back. I'll keep that in mind.
She's just an example. So, I mean, there's a lot of minor characters, especially female ones, that you do really well with. I mean, it's not just Draken and Elena. Nariari and all the others.
Yeah.
It's the minor characters as well that populate your world that really bring it to life. And I enjoyed spending time with them as much as you put them on the page and want to see some of them again.
Thank you. Well, I'll do my best, Paul.
Thank you. Okay,
so
Sean.
I did want to jump because you had mentioned that you're an editor.
Uh-huh.
And obviously an editor of short fiction.
Yep.
And I was wanted to kind of just broach a kind of general question for... as somebody who does deal with that, is what for you do you most enjoy about short fiction, and what for you are the biggest pet peeve about things that you read that are short in nature?
Oh, there's so many.
Okay, you can name 5,000.
How long can
if
we
you
run? You know, I like short fiction because, you know, it sounds trite. It's short. I like being able to get through a story in, you know, an hour or less. or even, you know, over your lunch hour is how I that's how I always envision people reading short fiction that's online, is like they have their lunch at their desk and they want to do something else, and maybe they're sick of Facebook, and so they click on a story and read a story. To me, that's how it should be done. And I guess because I read so many long fantasies, it's just refreshing to read short fiction. And there's just things you can do in short fiction. You can, I don't know, it's almost like you can take these really difficult topics and you can tolerate dealing with them because, I mean, sometimes because you're not going to be with it very long. So that's kind of, to me, the fun side of it. Pet peeves are, you know, too big a cast is probably one of the number one issues I see, and just too many words. Is it Stephen King who said his first editor said, you know, cut out 10%. Like, you know, whenever you think it's done, cut out another 10%. And Electric Spec we have up to 7,000 words. So we get some long stories that wouldn't go to other markets. And we're very strict with our 7,000 word limit, actually. And those stories are almost always, when we take them, they're almost always cut down significantly. Because they just don't need it. They don't need to be so long. What else? I don't like, what else don't I like? I don't know. It's been a while since I've read some. My slush is like growing, and it's been a while. And
you are currently open to submissions. So
I just had a book come out, man. That's like all I've done. So all the people under submission to Electric Spec have got to be like, are you going to ever respond? You know, I think not reading, you can tell people who haven't read short fiction. They seem to what, you know, they seem to write it, but, and I don't mean to say writing short fiction is bad. I think it's, I'm always surprised actually at novelists who say they haven't written any. I dropped out of writing novels for a year and wrote just short fiction. I concentrated on short fiction and I learned so much that year, and you can just turn stories around so quickly. You can write them quickly and then you can move on. You know, move on with your life, and it's not like the end of the world if you don't sell it because you only spent a month or whatever or less writing it.
Yeah, I was going to ask that how your stint in writing short fiction has changed you as a writer, be it epic or otherwise. Well, let me ask you this then. So now that
go ahead.
So how has now? I mean, you've been the editor. An editor for a lot longer than you've been a novelist. How has being a novelist twice now changed your editing or how you look at editing of shorter work?
Oh, that's a hard question.
I'm good at that.
I think they're really different animals. Because I write fantasy too, I let myself spread my wings a little bit and sprawl out. You know, I let myself describe, things that I wouldn't ever do in a short, you know, in a short story. Short stories are just so to the point that sometimes they can be a little grating because they're too much on the nose, too much on the point. You think, you know, I just would like to have a little more world here or something, to get my footing in. But it's such, to me, short fiction is so hard to write well, and it's really difficult to get all the pieces in that you need and to figure out. You know, it's probably the biggest thing is I think it's helped me, writing short fiction has helped me figure out what's important to put in a story and what's not important. Because in short fiction, as soon as something doesn't tie to something else, it goes. And that's harder to see in a novel. So it's like, if you can practice that a lot in short fiction, then you can apply it to novel writing.
Fair enough. Sean?
Fair enough. Well, I think that's a good time to kind of start to wrap up.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, two quick questions. The, first one is, where can folks find you and any convention appearances, say starting know earlier than next week that you'd like to let people know about?
I'm actually going to be at Starfest this weekend. We're fortunate to have a lot of local cons here in Denver. We have a great local con scene. So I'll be at Denver Comic Con next month. I can't remember the date, but I have an AMA coming up in May on Reddit. And then I have a little bit of a spell, and I'll be at Worldcon. And which I keep, this is kind of a joke, but I keep thinking we should start calling it like Awkward Con or something. Like it needs a new name. And then without going into it. And then I'll be at World Fantasy. That'll be the next big one. And I am under my name. If you Google my name, you can find me. I'm under my name on Twitter and Facebook, and of course, Sex Scenes at Starbucks. If you Google Sex Scenes at Starbucks, you'll find me easily enough.
Or you will find something very special.
I haven't Googled it for a while. You might.
Well, let us test that theory right now. Sex scenes.
Oh, great.
At Starbucks.
I'm just remembering a scene in Idiocracy. Have you seen Idiocracy, Betsy? It's a movie about a crapsack future where things have gotten coarse and polluted, and places like Starbucks, well, they don't serve coffee anymore, if you know what I mean.
Right.
Well, so, amusingly enough, you're pretty safe.
Yeah, I think I am. I mean, every time I've looked at it, it's pretty much all me, because I've been doing it since 2004, I think, is when I started it. So, yeah, and I wrote so much at the beginning that there's lots and lots and lots of posts to link to.
I will say that, amusingly enough, there is an article that shows up when you type in the key phrase about why Sophie Turner is not going to be dating.
Oh,
what?
Okay. Yeah, I don't know what that has. Well, because the phrase sex scenes and Starbucks both appear somewhere in the article
for reasons.
So Sophie Turner apparently doesn't have time for dating. So there you go, folks.
She's busy.
Here to hear first.
She is quite busy. She is kind of a main character on a TV show. So having to act alongside a character who's not a very nice person, but you know. What else? Presumably the actor's a nice person, but honestly, who knows?
Yeah. Well, sometimes, actors are just, it's like they're so good at what they do, it makes you wonder.
That's true. So, excellent. So, other than that, the other question obviously is, what have you got coming out that we should look forward to next?
Well, I don't know. Enemy, I'm kind of sitting around. Enemy is the name of the next book. And I don't have a date on that. And I have, it's kind of an odd position to be in currently right this minute that I don't have personally any stories or anything scheduled to come out. I do, we do publish Electric Spec 4 times a year. So I think at the end of May is the next one. So.
Okay, so keep an eye out for the next issue of Electric.
Keep an eye out for that. And it's free online. You can go read stories. We've got some just amazing stories in there. It's amazing what we get.
Excellent. Well, on that note, thank you so much, Betsy, for taking the time out to talk to us, and also for rescheduling because I contracted the plague.
Oh, you're right. You know what? I was actually snuffly today, so I was a little worried.
I'm so sorry I gave it to you by email.
You sound better, so that's good. I'm glad.
I'm mostly better. I'm 70%. I will say that.
Okay.
But I'm going to go take a nap after this for sure.
Okay.
Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
And Paul, obviously, thanks for being my co-host.
A pleasure as always. It was good to talk to Betsy.
Absolutely. And on that note, folks, awkward ending and scene. If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.